On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with hypnotherapist and regression specialist Jean-Charles Chabot.
Can you give us a quick example that there was a memory from early in life and they forgot about it, and then once they remembered it, it resolved some phobia for them?
For example, a person who had a fear of spider, and she says, like, I don't remember what could explain this fear of spider, but she couldn't get close to a fear of spider. And so, okay, so I brought her altered state of consciousness, and then I asked the unconscious mind to go back. So the first event the person went to was she was young, lying on the pool, and at some point, like, she just looked because it was a bit itching, and then it was a spider there, and she just kind of freaked at that point. And then what we usually do is we can ask the person, now I'm going to ask you a question. I don't want you to think. I want you to feel. Is this emotion, does it feel new, like, oh my God, what is this? Or is it familiar, like, oh, well, not again. And then was familiar. So I went, okay, now we're going all the way back to the source. And was what was very, very interesting, she was about 2 years old, and she was playing with a spider. There was a spider on her. And then she takes the spider and she puts it in her mouth. For a kid, no problem. But the problem was when the mother saw this and said, no. And then boom, association, spider dangerous, spider bad, mommy doesn't like it, I shouldn't like it. Okay, and that's where it all started.
Were you able to help her over her phobia then?
Oh, yeah. That was really interesting. For me, I like to test my work, right? So afterwards, we went in the basement looking for spiders. Okay. And then so we found some little spiders, and she could have them on her fingers. She was like, oh my God, I never did that before. And it was really amazing. So I said, okay, now let's take it a step higher. Let's go to the pet shop. And I had in mind, like, these tarantulas, you know, those big spiders. So I didn't know they were really dangerous. So I just went to the counter and said to the people, is it possible to look at the spiders, the tarantula, to play with them? And then the people at the counter was like, I'm going to try touching this. You know, I'm like, what? It's like, these can sting. They can really hurt. They're not going to kill you, but it can really, really hurt. I was like, oh, okay. And then the owner just came and said, no, they're really nice. All you have to do is just, as long as you don't do anything that irritates them, like blowing on them or be too like sudden moves and stuff, it's all fine. So he just went in the cage, took a spider, and then like he was playing, and he said, okay, you can just put your hand and like do the bridge, and then the spider would come, and she just had this amazing feeling of, oh my God, this is amazing, you know, and she couldn't do it without any problem. So that was really interesting.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, hypnosis. In fact, a very controversial area of hypnosis, that is past life and between life regression, where people purport to recall and recover memories of living in a previous life or the time they spent between lives, quite out there, if you will. So before I start with this interview, I thought I'd share a little bit about the path that I've taken in trying to get my arms around this topic. Let's start with reincarnation. Obviously, billions of people believe reincarnation is true. Moreover, thousands of people have reported personal experiences or memories suggesting that it's true. Is there any scientific evidence for this? Now, since I know the skeptical audience, I know that a lot of you know that there's actually quite a bit of very good evidence. Ian Stevenson, before he passed away, really pioneered this work at University of Virginia. He's been lauded for the methodology that he used, and he produced some very, very significant results that have really convinced a lot of people, you've heard some on this show, that were skeptically initially, but said, wow, this is good work. It's hard to look past this data. That work's been continued by Dr. Jim Tucker and others at the University of Virginia and others in other institutions. So there's reason to suspect that all these personal experiences might have some legitimacy behind them, scientific legitimacy. Now, the skeptical response to all this, and when I say skeptical, I mean mainstream science, their response has been to basically ignore the data and insist that it can't be true because you're a biological robot. Really, folks, that is the sum total of the response. Just ignore the data. But if we move past that ignore the data kind of position and accept that there's some solid evidence to at least investigate this, then we next have to turn to the topic of hypnosis and ask whether hypnosis can play a role in recovering these memories. Now, that turns out to be a very interesting question. In fact, the whole area of hypnosis is another one of these topics that you think you know about, but you don't realize until you dig into it that there's this whole hidden culture war debate associated with it. And I think it's really interesting to kind of understand the skeptical position, because I think it ties back to so many things I've been talking about the last few shows. And I know some of you get tired of me ranting and going on and on about biological robots and mind equal brain and how that's all over the place and how we have to deal with that. But I have to insist that it just keeps popping up everywhere, whether you want to or not. And it certainly does in the case of hypnosis. Let me give you an example. Take this quote from Scott Lilienfeld, professor of psychology, Emory University, fellow at the ultra-skeptical James Randi cultish atheist organization Center for Inquiry. He also writes for Scientific American, where he's one of their board of advisors, if that rings a bell with the secret scientific board of advisors that censored Rupert Sheldrake and Graham Hancock. You kind of get a feel for what's going on here. In 2009, he wrote an article in Scientific American titled, "Is Hypnosis a Distinct Form of Consciousness?" In it, he writes, "This issue, that is, whether hypnosis is a distinct form of consciousness, is of more than academic importance. If hypnosis differs in kind, rather than in degree, from ordinary consciousness, it could imply that hypnotized people can take actions that are impossible to perform in the waking state. It could also lend credibility to claims that hypnosis is a unique means of reducing pain or affecting dramatic psychological and medical cures." Did you catch that? It's very subtle. I mean, who cares if hypnosis is a distinct form of consciousness? And who cares if it's a unique means of reducing pain, right? We just care if it reduces pain. Wrong. What we care about is that you keep thinking you're a biological robot. What we care about is that there's no cracks in the mind equal brain mantra. And hypnosis, if it's a distinct form of consciousness, creates some interesting cracks in that mind equal brain mantra. And I think the best skeptical guest to point this out is University of Montreal professor Dr. Mario Beauregard, who wrote a very interesting book called Brain Wars, and we had him on, and he touched on this topic. And if you dive into his book, Brain Wars, you'll see study after study that he cites that directly contradicts this idea that there's nothing special about hypnosis, that it's not unique in any way, it's not really creating a different mental state, a different mental state of consciousness. And the studies that he cites are overwhelmingly suggestive. For example, they did hypnotic regressions and they told people to increase bone growth in a particular area, and then they go and they x-ray them after, and they have physicians who don't know which is the control group and which is not, and they analyze the x-rays and they say, yes, this group has more bone growth and that's the group that was under hypnotic suggestion. There's no way we know that people can do that consciously, yet that shows up again and again. Of course, though, you know this is true anyway, because you've seen it on stage where a hypnotist can hypnotize somebody and cause their finger to blister. I mean, this is really the same thing. So again, the pattern is repeated, where the skeptical argument tells you, you know, the old, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? Okay, so you've seen this, you know this is true, and yet the skeptical argument is telling you, no, 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 it can't be true. Don't trust your experience. Don't trust what other people have experienced. Believe me. Beauregard goes on and cites many, many other studies highly suggestive of this fact that the state of hypnosis is truly an altered state of consciousness and can best be described in what we would call a trance state. Again, this is something that skeptics resist with all effort. You'll see our old friend Dr. Steve Novella, neurologist from Yale and host of The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, in his blog, goes out of his way to say, not a trance state, ordinary mental state. Again, they have to support this idea that consciousness isn't real. And when we come across things that seem like an altered state of consciousness, like hypnosis, there's this real need to push it down in some way and give the promise that we'll be able to track it all back to brain function. Just wait and it'll all work out. Again, this might seem like kind of an obscure argument, but when you sort through what's really going on, you see that this is at the center of this debate over hypnosis. But of course, that's not what we're really interested here in this episode of Skeptico. We're asking the question, can hypnosis be effective in recovering memory? Now, really, the question that we asked before is hypnosis an altered state of consciousness? Is highly relevant to this other question, but let's take it separately. That is, can hypnosis be effective in recovering memory? Now, you have to be careful how you ask and who you ask this question. If you ask it to the Center for Inquiry, Scientific American, skeptical atheist crowd, you're going to be led down this road and told a lot about false memory, how memories are implanted in people who are highly suggestible, and therefore we got to throw all this hypnosis and memory stuff out the window. And some of what they're telling you is definitely true. False memory syndrome, implanted memories are real. It really does happen. But what they aren't going to tell you is there's many, many studies that suggest people have this remarkable ability to recover memories under hypnosis that they couldn't otherwise remember. Some of the research I did before this show, getting into this, I ran across a couple of researchers at the University of Liverpool in England, and they're just one among a number of researchers who've done a lot of good, solid research on this and found different ways that forensic psychologists can use hypnosis effectively to help witnesses recover evidence. And there's all sorts of these cases. People that can't remember faces are able to. People that can't remember license plates are able to. The police are then able to follow up with that license plate, find out information, get convictions. All of this has been not only proven in cases, but it's been proven clinically in labs where they then test people with different kind of induction techniques, different populations. There's just tons of research out there. It's very easy to find. Go to Google Scholar and start searching for it, and you'll find many, many studies. And at the end of the day, the only conclusion that you can come to is that while false memory is true, it's also a reality that the hypnotic state is very effective for recovering lost memories. Of course, the other thing that our skeptical friends don't want to talk about is that we don't really know how memory works anyway. And as we've talked about on this show, we have some very solid evidence that suggests that this idea that all memory is stored in the cells of your brain isn't real. We have that from the near-death experience research where people die and they have memories during a period when they had no brain. That's overwhelming evidence. So there's a lot of questions. The answers are messy. They don't tightly fit. Are there false memories? There appear to be false memories. Is there a reality to recovered memories? There seems to be a reality to recovered memories. Is there an ability that we have to create illusions and fantasies? Absolutely. Is it possible that some of the illusions and fantasies that people are creating have some kind of allegorical or metaphorical meaning that is true on another level? I don't know. That's far beyond the realm of what we're trying to nail down here. But I think all those questions must be then thrown on the table if we dig a little bit deeper past this skeptical silliness. So since we're trying to figure out what's really going on, we might want to give a listen to people who are out there at the edge doing this work, like today's guest, Jean-Charles Chabot. Fascinating guy who I really enjoyed talking with. Here's my interview with him. Today we welcome Jean-Charles Chabot to Skeptico. Jean-Charles is a hypnotherapist based in Montreal who specializes in regression therapy. I came across his work through several of his excellent YouTube videos that actually show him doing past life and between life regressions in a clinical setting in his office in Montreal. Fascinating stuff. Jean-Charles, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, Alex.
Tell folks a little bit about what you do, what your practice is all about, and some of this work you do in regression therapy.
Okay, so basically I'm specialized in what we call a spiritual hypnosis, which includes past life regression, life between life regression. We're going to talk a bit about that. And also specialize in what we call street hypnosis or impromptu hypnosis, which I prefer to call, because street hypnosis, sometimes people have this negative idea about it. And I also do what we call therapeutic hypnosis, which is can include regression, but also just therapeutic techniques to help maybe with phobias or stop smoking and stuff like that.
Great. So I think in reviewing your website, and I don't have a lot of experience in hypnosis, but I was quite impressed by your credentials, by your training. Tell us a little bit about your background and specifically who you've trained with to develop your practices.
My background, I have a master's in education. So that's what I studied. I also have a bachelor's in career counseling. And after my master's in education, I went to China actually for 5 years doing what we call corporate training, soft skills training, where I was teaching training about self-confidence building, presentation skills, meeting skills, emotional intelligence skills, stuff like that. And I've always been interested in hypnosis for a long, long time actually. And I started to read books and even integrate group hypnosis sessions in my training, which was really cool. But at some point I was like, I'd like to learn more about this, to be trained in this. So in 2008, I went to, when I was still in China, I went to the United States to study first with Cal Banyan, the very quite famous hypnotist in the States, in California. And that's where it kind of all started, because what was really interesting in this training is that Cal was, you know, like the normal clinical hypnotist, but it also has the spiritual part, where created this technique called the informing soul, which is about basically bringing the person before their incarnation to go and get knowledge. So I was like, oh, that's interesting. And I was in China for 5 years. So at some time, like every year and a half or so, I would go down back to Montreal, see my parents and see my family. And one day I was went in the basement I forgot what it was, to look for something, and it was a very high shelf. And I was like trying to grab something. I don't remember what it was, but there was a book on the left that fell down. I was like, well, that's strange. So I picked up the book, and it was Michael Newton's book about Journey of Souls, which is about, like, he's a bit like the pioneer in this work. And I just started reading this, and just inside of me was like a click or something. I just want to do this. I need to do this. That's my, what we call, could call the calling, my calling. And at that point, I just started to read a lot of books and start to get trained with all the best guys in this field, like whether it's the Newton Institute, Dolores Cannon, Brian Weiss. And I just basically went to train with all these big people and analyze what's their technique, what are the principles behind their techniques to create my own approach to past life regression and also in between life regression.
Fascinating work. It's obviously very controversial to a lot of people. And as I mentioned, as we were chatting a little bit beforehand, what I thought we might do to kind of lead people up into an awareness or being a little bit more receptive to the possibility that there is some reality to what you're talking about, because it really is going to be mind-blowing to a lot of people.
Yeah.
I thought it might be helpful to go over some of the basics of hypnosis, because While on your YouTube channel, I saw some other presentations that you've done. You've really done some amazing work. I mean, you've studied with all these different hypnotherapists. You've also set up an institute. Is it the Institute for Spiritual Hypnosis? Is that right?
Yeah, it's the International Institute for Spiritual Hypnosis. Yeah, where the goal is to actually do research, because what people may be interested to know is that I'm also a very rational and scientific person as a personality, and I also collaborate with the Psycho Neuro Institute in Montreal, where we also start to do research using brain waves to see what happens when people are in hypnosis, when they have a spiritual experience. So that's why, like, the Institute was created to do research and also to do training, to train people, because especially in the French world, there's not a lot of people doing past life regression or life between life regression, and who have the skills to do it well, because it's, as we're probably going to talk in a few moments, there's some really important skills required to do this in a good way.
Great, and I definitely want to get to that. I want to take just a minute and back up on talk about what you just said, because I think it's important that you are taking this very scientific approach to this work, and you're trying to meld that with the spiritual aspect, which is much more difficult to pin down scientifically.
Yeah.
And I thought what we might just talk about for someone who is totally coming at this cold is review the clinical underpinnings, the experimental underpinnings of hypnosis, because a lot of people don't realize that there are hundreds and hundreds, just masses of clinical experimental work that's been done with all kinds of hypnosis in all kinds of different medical situations. So anyone who goes and Googles hypnosis on Google Scholar, where there's these scholarly papers, will just be pointed to that. But maybe you want to just kind of start with the very basics with, does hypnosis really work? Is it used clinically? Is it used in hospitals? Is it used in medical situations?
Yeah, for sure. I often find it really interesting when I meet people, and then sometimes people, I don't know if I believe in it. Like today, if someone is slightly curious, and as you mentioned, goes on the web, there's tons of clinical research that's been done. And what I think is the most impressive and convincing is regarding to pain control. That's probably the branch of hypnosis that has the most research and is most convincing in the way that you cannot fake not having pain, okay? It's not something that you can pretend not to have pain if you have an operation. There's even some clips that I've seen, like the operation on the brain or the head, like opening up, and the person talking to the interviewer. You know, there's stuff with pain control that either to reduce pain or to take away pain completely, depending on the receptivity of the subject. But that's the area that is most convincing, and and what proves that it really works, and that there's specific courses for dentists, for doctors, anesthesiologists to use these hypnosis principles at work. So that's a proof that it really is not a belief. It's a state, and it really works, basically.
And then bringing that into the regression field is something we just touched on a minute ago. And one thing I've encountered is a lot of times people are aware or educated to a certain extent to the reality of hypnosis being used medically, or they have a friend who's used it for weight loss or cessation of smoking or something like that. They know it's out there. They know there's some clinical proof to it. But then when you start talking about regression, they're like, oh, but that's, you know, that's way, way out there. And what I thought was interesting in one of the presentations I saw you give is you connected the fact that regression is often a common technique used in other kinds of hypnotherapy. Can you maybe talk a little bit about that and what role regression plays in hypnotherapy?
Yes, for sure. Basically, because regression is one technique among many others that can be used when we do pure therapeutic hypnosis, okay? And what regression is basically is going back to usually an event or something that happens, usually between 0 and 7 years old, but doesn't have to be, but usually in that time to go back to the source, what we call in hypnosis the ISC, which is the initial sensitizing event where it all started, basically. And so there's many types, there are many ways to do regression as well. People have to understand you can regress on a feeling, you can regress on a thought, on a belief, going back to an important moment. There's many ways of regressing, of giving the unconscious an instructions to go back to a certain time. And a very useful way of doing regression is like either connecting to a feeling, an uncomfortable feeling, or something that the person wants to resolve, and just to ask the unconscious to go back all the way back to the source, to the where it all started, like to the cause of that. And that's where usually when you do phobias, and it's really interesting because I've had people who say, oh, I don't know where it comes from. I have this fear of water, for example. I don't know where it comes from. It must come from a past life. It's important to know, to understand that it's not because the person doesn't remember that necessarily means it's in a past life. I always tell people, I say, listen, we'll bring you in an altered state of consciousness and we'll ask your unconscious mind to bring you back to the cause. If it's a past life, it's a past life. It's when you're young, it's when you're young. And very often something happened when they're young, but they just blocked or unconsciously forgot. And we reconnect to that, which is really interesting because it's something that consciously they totally forgot.
Can you give us a quick example of maybe a case where that's happened? I'm sure you have many in your therapy, and then how that resolved something for someone, that there was a memory from early in life and they forgot about it, and then once they remembered it, it resolved some phobia for them.
Yeah. For example, I'll give you a couple examples. One with regression in this life and past life. Okay, regression like. For example, a person who had a fear of spider. Okay, I had a friend, and she says, like, I don't remember anything about the what could explain this fear of spider, but she couldn't get close to a fear of spider. And so, okay, so I brought her in an altered state of consciousness, and then I asked the unconscious mind to go back, and then we went back to... And sometimes even if we ask the unconscious mind to go back to the source or the origin, it doesn't always go there first. So we always have to ask again. So the first event the person went to was she was young, lying on the pool. And then there was she lying beside the pool. She just got out of the water and there was like little drops of water like dripping down her body. And at some point, like she just looked because it was a bit itching. And then there was a spider there, and she just kind of freaked at that point. And then what we usually do is we can ask the person, now I'm going to ask you a question. I don't want you to think. I want you to feel. Is this emotion, does it feel new, like, oh my God, what is this? Or is it familiar, like, oh, well, not again. And then was familiar. So I went, okay, now we're going all the way back to the source. And what was very, very interesting, she was about 2 years old, and she was playing with a spider. There was a spider on her. When we're 2 years old, it doesn't matter, right? It's just a spider. And then so until then, there's nothing wrong. And then she takes the spider and she puts it in her mouth. For a kid, no problem. But the problem was when the mother saw this and said, no. And then boom, association, spider dangerous, spider bad, mommy doesn't like it. I shouldn't like it. Okay, and that's where it all started. Okay, so that's very interesting when you have things like that, that just you understand where it comes from, and then you can do some techniques. One technique among the others, like the informed child technique, where you instruct the child what he would have needed to know, not to be conditioned by this, and then we irradiate this knowledge throughout life, and there's many things you can do.
Were you able to help her over her phobia then?
Oh, yeah. That was really interesting. Because afterwards, because for me, I like to test my work, right? So afterwards, we went in the basement looking for spiders. Okay. And then so we found some little spiders and she could have them on her fingers. She was like, oh my God, I never did that before. And it was really amazing. So I said, okay, now let's take it a step higher. Let's go to the pet shop. And I had in mind like these tarantulas, you know, those big... spiders. So I didn't know they were really dangerous. So I just went to the counter and said to the people, is it possible to look at the spiders, the tarantula, to play with them. And then the people at the counter was like, I'm going to try touching this. You know, I'm like, what? It's like, these can sting. They can really hurt. They're not going to kill you, but it can really, really hurt. I was like, oh, okay. And then the owner just came and said, no, they're really nice. All you have to do is just, as long as you don't do anything that irritates them, like blowing on them or be too like sudden moves and stuff, it's all fine. So he just went in the cage, took a spider, and then like he was playing and he said, okay, you can just put your hand and like do the bridge. And then the spider would come and she just had this amazing feeling of, oh my God, this is amazing, you know? And she couldn't do it without any problem. So that was really interesting.
Great. You know, and then one of the things in your presentation that I found was just fascinating, maybe this will lead into the second story that you're going to tell. And I think I've seen an interview with Michael Newton where he confirms the same thing. Michael Newton, as you just mentioned, being a real pioneer in this idea of past life and between life therapy. But that sometimes this past life regression will just happen spontaneously. So a therapist can just run across this, even if they aren't open to the idea of someone being in a past life, they'll just go there.
Exactly. And that's, to be honest, Alex, that's the part I would say that convinced me or attracted me, because it's something that's totally independent of the hypnotherapist and the client. Even if the hypnotherapist doesn't believe in past life, or the client doesn't believe in past life when he's in that state of hypnosis, and we give suggestion, and the way why it usually comes spontaneously is that when we ask to go back to the source, to the cause of the problem, and that's why like the hypnotherapists, and I've met quite a few hypnotherapists before, they didn't believe in past life, they weren't even open, but if you do regression as part of your work, as a technique, because not all hypnotherapists use regression, but if you use that, when I took my course, they said, whether you believe it or not, it's going to happen. So here's what you do when it happens, even if you don't believe it, okay? And that's why, like, you just ask the unconscious mind, go all the way back to the source, and sometimes a person who might have a fear of water would start saying, like, I'm drowning, and what's happening, it's 1623 and blah blah blah, there's this happening, and that's where it came from, the source, the origin, because the unconscious mind is like everything that we experience as a soul, and here we're starting to use concepts, more spiritual concepts, has access to. And that's why it's very fascinating, because if you just do regression going back to the source, it will happen maybe 2-3% of the time, but it does happen even if people don't believe in it, which is really interesting.
Can you think of a case where maybe that happened to you, where you weren't necessarily trying to lead someone into a past life and they spontaneously went into a past life? And then how would you recognize that they were in a past life?
Yeah, I mean, like, we recognize when they're in a past life where the setting is totally different. For example, like, I had and this happened a lot. Sometimes people have a pain, okay, like a back pain that they didn't know where it come from. So just connecting with the back pain and going back to the source where it all started, and the person just pops in the battlefield, okay? Somebody stabbing them,
right?
And like accessing this, and like, you know, it's not in their present life, because there's,
right,
you know,
because they're not soldiers, in the back. Right? Yeah,
exactly. You know, and sometimes they die in that way, and it's as if, and I don't understand everything. I'm interested. That's why I'm interested. But how can that memory be? You know, how does it work? Really, I don't know. We don't know much about it, but we know that there seems to be something connecting and having like influence from past life to present life. And that's really fascinating when it happens spontaneously, especially if the client doesn't come to me for past life regression. Today, I would say it's more rare that it happens spontaneously, because I'm specialized in spiritual hypnosis. So people come to me for past life. But even if they come to me and say, as I mentioned before, like, there's this pain or this fear or this whatever, this unexplained emotion, I don't know where it comes from, it must come from a past life, we have to be really careful. It's not true. And that would not be a professional from the hypnotist to say to the unconscious, okay, now go all the way back to a past life where this pain came from. that's the typical mistake that some hypnotists who are not really qualified will make, because we cannot make this assumption, basically.
You know, there's a lot of open areas that need a lot of further research, as you just alluded to, and it sounds like something you're open to. One thing I wanted to do in this discussion is maybe nail down some of the open mysteries and also some of the myths associated with hypnosis. And as I was mentioning to you a minute ago, I do want to get past the fluffy white cotton stuff, because, you know, you can Google hypnosis and you'll get a lot. It's safe. You know, there's never anything bad that's going to happen. You'll remember everything and all this, which I don't know, maybe true to a certain extent. But I guess I also sometimes feel when I read that it kind of belies the power of the tool. I mean, if hypnosis can do all these amazing things, then it can't be all those other things too. So in that spirit, can we really kind of tell it like it is about the reality of hypnosis? And I guess I'd start with, can we ever get someone to do something under hypnosis that is against their will, whatever that means? And I guess to me, it's obvious. Of course you can. I mean, yeah. Of course you can. Some people you can get to do some things against their will. That seems to be self-evident from the fact that hypnosis works.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what usually we see in stage hypnosis or street hypnosis, you know, like giving suggestion that you're stuck on your chair and you can't get up. And even if you try, it doesn't work, you know. So that's an example of it's against their will. They try, they really consciously try, and they can't, okay? But that happens, let's say, because a part of the person is okay with that, okay? Like unconsciously, it's not threatening, it's not life-threatening. They're open to the experience in some ways. But what is most controversial is, can you make somebody do something against their values or that they wouldn't do, that they wouldn't even want to do? Because, I mean, they're like getting stuck on a chair. There's nothing bad, you know, related to that. But to take advantage of someone by stealing something from them or stuff like that. Some people, you know, a lot of hypnotherapists will tell their clients, you will never do something that you wouldn't want to do, anything against their values. And the truth, Alex, it's not true. Okay. If you have some hypnotist who is ill-intentioned, who doesn't have a good intention, he could take advantage. I mean, you never see this in hypnotherapy settings, because if the hypnotherapist would steal or do something, the client would come back, okay? My advice to people would be, like, if they do it in the street, for example, to make sure you're not alone, you're with friends, okay, and that you trust the person. But I'm going to explain to you why it works, okay? Because in hypnosis, the strength comes from being in control of the frame of reality that we present to the person. Because I know a hypnotherapist who even did research in this industry, not just to see, can we really make someone do something that they wouldn't want to do normally? And then he did do some stuff. And one thing that he did is hypnotize somebody to steal their coat. Okay, to see would the person get the coat? Would the hypnotherapist get the coat? And of course, if you're doing, you bring the person under hypnosis and you give the suggestion next time your eyes will open, you will give me your coat. Okay, internally, there's something against the values, you know, like that's my coat, that's not your coat. There would be more resistance. Okay, but if the person would say, now at a count of three, your eyes will open, you will realize that the coat you're wearing is my coat, okay? And you'll feel really bad about wearing my coat, and you'll just give it back to me. And then when you frame it like this, it doesn't go against the values, okay? And that's where things can happen in some ways. And most hypnotherapists don't talk about this because they don't want to scare their clients. I prefer to tell the truth. It is possible. In hypnotherapy settings, it doesn't happen. Because, I mean, the person would remember. And even if the hypnotherapist gives the suggestion that you will forget, amnesia, it's not very stable for these kind of things. So it wouldn't even be worth the risk of remembering, like my client, remembering that I stole whatever or did whatever that's bad. So hypnotherapist, it doesn't happen. So I don't want to scare people. But as you mentioned, there can be it's not all pink and happy and nothing can happen. There, if you're with the person in the street that has bad intention, they could do something, okay? And so that's why my advice to people, if you're in the street, do and you have a hypnotist come to you, make sure you have friends around and you just get a good feeling of the person. And the other thing I want to bring is especially doing regression with the thing with false memories. Okay, that's something, that's another thing that can do damages in some ways. And if the hypnotherapist is well-trained, that's fine. But we have to understand that in hypnosis, person is really receptive. And what is very important in all regression training is what we call the mistake of doing inappropriate leading. Have you heard of this?
Just casually. So I think it's an important topic to talk about because, and again, touching on what you just said before, I certainly don't want to scare anyone away from this valuable tool.
But not at
by
all,
the same
yeah.
token, as you're mentioning, I think we have to honor the power of this tool and we shouldn't diminish it by saying, oh, it's just all easily maneuvered or easily understood, because it's not. And I think this other area that you're getting into is very controversial and it is very scary for people. And that is the idea that they could be so open and so receptive that they could be implanted with memories that aren't real memories and that could somehow harm them in some way by destroying their idea of who they are by what they remember. So what is the real scoop on that, Jean-Charles?
Well, to avoid creating any false memories, the hypnotist has to be really careful as not to impose his own presupposition in the client's experience. And I'll give you a classic example of why in the past hypnosis was taken to court and it was discredited, is that if the hypnotist, for example, let's say an example, a client comes to a hypnotist and says, I want to see if I was abused when I was young. Okay. A bad hypnotist would bring the person in an altered state of consciousness and would say, now I'm going to count from 3 down to 1 and you're going to go all the way back to the time you were abused. Presupposition that they were abused. And this is a mistake, a big no-no in regression, because you don't want to presuppose that they were abused. But if the hypnotist is not skilled, it's just trying and let's explore. The client could potentially create an experience which is not true. Okay, that's why this is called inappropriate leading. And inappropriate leading can be done, in different ways. I don't know, if I go back to a child, you're a child and you're eating food and having fun and throwing food on the floor and stuff like that. And if the hypnotherapist and says, your parents must not be very happy about this. Okay. And this is leading. It's a good hypnotherapist. And how does your parent feel about this? If it's relevant, of course, it's just an example. But that's why it's very important. And when I do certification for the Institute, because just something like that about the Institute, I do certification contrary to some other schools sometimes. They have to prove they have good skills to do regression. And it can be very subtle. For example, the person goes back to an event, not necessarily in childhood, or maybe where there's someone dying or a ceremony and everything happening. And then if the hypnotist said, and how do you feel as you're there? It's as if implying they should feel bad, And this kind of leading could, and it's not as fragile. People have to understand it's not as fragile. Even if you do leading mistakes, sometimes people will tell you this is not happening. And they will correct you even if you had the presupposition. It's not as fragile. I don't want to scare people. But it's just if you have a hypnotherapist who does a lot of leading mistakes, there's a chance that a false memory could be created, and we don't want that.
And what you're suggesting is also challenging in a way, because we just don't know how all this stuff really works. And I mean, here you are, you're a very skilled practitioner, and you can reliably get certain results, but it does seem like in these other areas, we don't know why people would confabulate and form a false memory? Why would the mind work like that? I mean, these are open questions, right?
Yeah. And I'm really glad you brought that, because also, like, I mean, because there's basically two types of regression. You know, there's present life regression and past life and between lives regression. Past life usually done in childhood, and past life, well, doing in the past. And what's very important, and that's often a taboo, I would say, in training, in past life training, because it's as if, like, people take for granted it should be all true. I don't think it's true that all memories access are necessarily real past life. I do believe there's a lot that is real, because, I mean, when you experience and you see, and especially when you can, I mean, if we're purely logical, rational, we should only accept if we can verify some things. Okay, and I've had clients verify information about stuff that, you know, you can't read in the journal in little villages buried, you know, a long time ago, and then you find information. It does happen. But what also can happen is that the unconscious may create a metaphor, okay, for the individuals to either understand or release something. And it doesn't have to be less important or even powerful, because I've had clients I truly believe were metaphors, because metaphors are different from past life. There's something more symbolism and stuff like that, and not really doesn't feel true. Like, I've been doing this for a while, so I can get a feel of both, but the person just changed like a deep change. Like, the unconscious, even through dreams, communicate with symbols, with metaphors. That's the language of the unconscious. So if the unconscious mind chooses to give, instead of giving access to a past life, chooses to create a metaphor to either release something or help understand some things, that's fine. You know, it's, we have to get away from, is it real or not, from how is it beneficial for the individual? What can be used to either understand? Was it helpful? What's the therapeutic benefits of this? Instead of just focusing, was it real or not? That's not the real question when you do this kind of work with the intention of self-growth, basically.
Fascinating. I love the way you handle that, because I love the openness to all the different possibilities that might exist. And at the same time, your rigor and your focus about how we should approach it in terms of results. So with that as kind of a background, take people through what typically happens in a past life or a between life regression, and I'm not sure how those would be different, and what typically why someone would come to you for that, and then typically what they would experience during that kind of session.
Yeah, sure. I guess I'll just start by making a difference between past life regression and in between life regressions. Past life regression, basically, well, most people know about this, going back to another incarnation where you have a different body, different name, different time, different physiology. Okay, you don't necessarily look like what you look like today. Couldn't be a different gender. Okay, and so that's past life. And the reasons why we may be interested in doing past lives is to either understand some things in your present life where something, situation or illness or pain or whatever comes from, or emotions that you don't know where it comes from. It can be to release blockages or to unblock something, and can be also to reaccess some resources or states, you know, that you've had that would be beneficial for you. An example of that would be someone who has very low self-esteem in this lifetime. And also what's important to mention is the way I work. I always ask the higher consciousness, okay, to bring the person back to a lifetime that has a lot of influence on their present life. So even if they had, I tell people, whatever you've been told about past life, we put it on the side. There's a lot of psychics, people telling stuff. Sometimes it may be true, sometimes it's not. So I tell people, we don't just, let's put this on the side and let's just say what your higher consciousness wants to show you to help you in some ways. And so the person would access a past life that would have significant on their present life to either understand, or coming back to the self-confidence thing, the person could access. And I had a client recently where she was really confident in a past life. You know, she was this person, not a big title, not a popular person, but she had just this confidence, and it kind of created a resource inside the person that she could feel, and all the cells, all the body, it's just create a resource that afterwards she could feel it would be easier to tap into that. Okay, so that's an example of why someone would do past life. Now, life between lives is something is less understood, and it's even more complex. Okay, basically, in between lives is where what happens after we die in the past life. So typically, in a typical process, although there's other ways of doing it, a typical process, you will go back to a past life and you'll bring the person to the death scene and go after the death, okay? And that's where it's really interesting, because there's a lot of similarities between NDE experiences, people report a near-death experiences, and also what happens that, like separating from the body, sometimes going through a tunnel or going somewhere there's light, meeting beings and all this. And the reasons, there may be many reasons why someone may be interested in that. It can be to reconnect with their spiritual nature, you know, like to, because I don't know if you've heard the expression, we're not human beings having spiritual experience, we're a spiritual being having a human experience. I would say in a nutshell, that's basically what this process helps people to reconnect with their spiritual aspect of themselves. And it could be to reconnect with what we call the life mission or the life contract, which in this frame of mind is there's a reason why we would incarnate. Okay, there's some things we want to resolve or to do, or some qualities to develop, to grow as a soul. Okay, so that's the principle behind this. And I also don't like the term life mission. I'm probably going to change that, because a lot of people think mission, you know, this big mission, I came here to change the world, I came this, you know. I prefer to use the term contract, because it can be something very simple. It might not have anything to do professionally, you know, to learn to forgive, to learn to assert yourself, learn, you know, qualities like this. It doesn't have to be this big thing that life mission sometimes triggers in people, you know. So life mission to understand why you're here, basically, you know, you incarnated.
More like life suggestions or recommendations, right? I mean,
yeah. I mean, like to reconnect with what you decided to do when you came in this incarnation to help you move forward on that path. And some people can be to reconnect with the nature of what we call spirit guides, okay, or sometimes people call angels, and it's really fascinating when people connect with them and with a guide, and they have this experience of unconditional love. Like, yeah, you see stuff when you do this work. Sometimes I even cry. Clients will report very often feelings of love, unconditional love, that they've never felt in their incarnation. It's as if like something really profound, and also to reconnect with their true nature. It's as if like there's Alex, there's Jean-Charles, there's our masks, okay, these rental cars that we have throughout lifetimes. And then when we start to connect even slightly with the essence, this spark or this light inside of you, this timeless kind of self in some ways, and people feel an expansion, and they can have an experience of really a transformative experience of their whole perceptions. Because what we have to understand is when you have these experiences, it really can change many things. For example, if someone, had a parent, okay, very unloving, you know, like very tough on the child, on the client when he was young, and then you go back in between lives and you find out you had a contract with that soul who would give you trouble, so that you can either reconnect yourself with your feeling of self-love and to have some growth experience to grow out of this. And when you really understand the contract, it really helps for forgiveness, but also at a highest level, you can even have gratitude for that soul to be on your path, to have given you that much trouble, so that it could trigger some qualities or competence that you wouldn't have developed if you just had loving parents, okay? So that makes a huge switch in someone's mind. It can also be used to get rid of fear of dying. When you're just going in a past life, throughout a past life and dying, I remember in Colorado, I had a a person who was an engineer, you know, really rational, had trouble accessing the state, was questioning a lot. And I don't know if I'm making this up. And I'm like, well, that's so fine, just keep going. And then we arrive at the death scene. And she just starts crying and just goes deeper at that point. And what I didn't know, even before we talked, the person has a really deep fear of death. And her husband would say, like, she wouldn't even go a week without talking about it. She was, like, really into this. And then we were all eating together. And then and she said to her husband, you know what? I think I'm not afraid anymore. He was just like, what? You know? So these things that can help for a grief process. Another interesting thing that really surprised me as well is sometimes people or dead people, relatives, loved ones can sometimes connect and have interaction that helps to free and to help like forgiveness. And there, so there's many, many things that can happen in these types of life between life experience.
It's amazing. I have to say, I think for a lot of people, it's a lot to take in. It's very challenging on so many levels. And in the little bit of time that we have left, I want to touch on a couple of things. I think it's very important the way, and I love this approach that you have, of coming back to the measurable effects that your clients have. They're either better or they're not better. And I think for the person who's more cynical or skeptical, they'll go, well, those are just anecdotes. And I don't think that's true. I mean, I think in a therapeutic session, this is what we measure all the time. I mean, if you're a psychotherapist, a psychoanalyst, you know, you're doing therapy and people are either better or they're not based on how they report. And we compare that to drugs. We can give someone drugs to overcome grief. We can give them antidepressants to overcome grief. We can give them psychotherapy to overcome grief. Or we could give them a past life or between life regression therapy, and we could measure that. So it always amazes me where people want to kind of just dismiss it and slide off the table and say, that's not scientific. We can't measure it. Of course we can measure it. We measure that kind of stuff all the time to find out what is most efficacious. So if you have anything to add to that, great. But then the last thing that I want to really get on, what the heck does this mean? I mean, this is challenging in so many ways. Soul contract, life groups, life missions. It's not about this life. It's about the next life. How does someone figure this stuff out, figure out how to incorporate this into their worldview? How are your clients making that leap of understanding?
I mean, like the clients that I see are usually open to reincarnation, to these principles or these concepts of having a soul group, having a life mission and all this. But what is most interesting, and when you have clients, and that's where I guess the point that is worth mentioning is that even if the client doesn't believe in it, and I've had clients, okay, who come in the office and say, you know what, I'm very skeptical. And I say, that's fine.
But my wife made me come, or my husband made me come.
Yeah. Yeah. And I tell people, as long as you're open to have an experience, then it's fine. Because if the person wants to prove it's not going to work or doesn't want to believe that it's possible, then they're going to block the experience. They're not going to follow your suggestion. They're not going to let it happen. But if the person says to me, you know what, I'm very skeptical, but I'm open, that's perfect. And that's when you have these people who haven't read a lot about this stuff, who are very skeptical and who have these really profound experiences, who not only on the spot are very meaningful and very touching and all this, but it goes integrates in their life. Things change in their life, in their interaction with others, with themselves, perceptions of the world. There's really a noticeable changes that can take place at many, many levels. And sometimes even at levels that you haven't touched during the session, which is really interesting. I've had like a chiropractor who came to see me who had this really deep pain, and we've did work, past life, life between life. And it just like, because we do, I always ask the higher consciousness to do healing and stuff, but I wasn't specifically toward the pain. I didn't even know about it. And the guy just reported the day after, was like, you know what? This pain that I've had for years is gone. So there's, we don't understand, Alex. We don't understand exactly how it works. It's a bit like a car, and you know how to drive. We know what to do. But, you know, like for, I mean, some people know how cars works, but you don't need to know how the car works to use a car, you know. So it's very fascinating. And I honestly think that as changes, I mean, there's big changes in the world. There's a lot of people are more open now. I get more and more clients who are not even into spirituality. They're just very sincere about knowing more about themselves. And I think in the future, this kind of spiritual hypnosis will be more and more popular because it just takes, even for a therapist, like psychologists. In my classes, I have psychologists, doctors who don't want to be on the website, but they want to use it personally with their clients. Because, I mean, like there's orders. I don't know how it is in the States, but it's a bit more touchy. But it just gives you a broader sense of the situation of client, even the karmic influences, why they're here. So if they have this problem and you can manage to get a wider view, it's just more helpful overall to help the client.
Well, great, Jean-Charles. And we will definitely have a link to your website and a couple of your websites. But in the little bit of time we have left, tell folks how they might get in contact with you if they're interested in this or want to learn more about it or want to watch some of your excellent YouTube videos.
I have my YouTube website. I guess if you just write Jean-Charles Chabot, there's not many people on YouTube with that name, so that shouldn't be quite easy. I have my in English, livebetweenlives.ca, so it's live-between-lives.ca. This is my English personal website. And also there's a website, we're in French right now, for the Institute, which is hypnosespirituelle.com. Maybe it's going to be on the page where, I don't know. Anyway, so there's these two websites where if people want to connect with me through my, it all can also be at infohypnose, infohypnose at jcchabot.com. So that's my email address that I can be reached at. And if for some reason it comes, I'm really busy. I'm like, it's kind of months in advance to have an appointment. But at the Institute, I train people and I chosen a few people who are really qualified. So if people want to start with a past life regression with some of the people I've trained, it's also possible.
Well, great. It's really great work, and it's been terrific covering the many topics that we did, and I really appreciate you coming on. Thanks so much for joining me today on Skeptico.
Thank you, Alex. It was a pleasure.
Thanks again to Jean-Charles Chabot for joining me today on Skeptico. A couple of questions I might tee up from this interview. The first relates back to the introduction. I'd ask, what does hypnotic regression and hypnosis in general tell us about consciousness? Talked about that a little bit at the beginning. Love to get your take on it. The second question is, do you think it's possible to access memories of a time before you were born? This is, after all, the claim that's being made by people who do past life, between life regressions. How do you sort out the evidence for that? How would we know? How would we sort through that question? So, of course, the place to answer those questions and engage with other Skeptico listeners is either on the Skeptico forum or in the comment section of the Skeptico website. You can reach both through the website at skeptiko.com. You'll also find there links to over 200 previous shows, a link where you can subscribe for free on iTunes to all of our shows, and an email and a Facebook link to me. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. I have a number of interesting shows piled up, so please stay with me for all of that. But until next time, take care and bye for now.